seeing as she was shocked that this almost happened, or she thought, or the Satan told her Yitzchak was killed. But some say that she was shocked when she saw them coming back, because she thought, Chas v'shalom, that Avraham and Yitzchak could not pass the test. Her shock was that all of the ideals that she tried to instill were not realized. Again, that's going the other way. Now, there's a big kasha here that a lot of the literary theorists and the Bill Moyers crowd, they haven't gotten to the Akedah yet, but they will certainly bring this up, because it's very popular in circles. In fact, Rabbi Riskin said it, the place of where the Avos live is very peculiar here. Because at the time of the Akedah, it's very, very clear that Avraham is living in Be'er Sheva. Right? They left from Be'er Sheva. They had lived in Hebron. The first 25 years of Avraham's stay until the birth of Yitzchak was in Hebron. But then they moved to Be'er Sheva. Remember, that was the land of the Philistines, etc. And yet, we find that Sarah Imenu dies in Hebron.
And he buried her there.
He buried her there because that's where she died. So what is Sarah Imenu doing in Hebron if Avraham and Yitzchak are in Be'er Sheva? And if you look at a map, you know Be'er Sheva is not even near Hebron that much. So what is the popular vogue theory, which everybody likes to bandy around, is that Sarah separated from Avraham after the Akedah. That there's not like Chazal that say Sarah died right away, and that she refused to continue with her husband because he was willing to go ahead and kill their only son.
Obviously
the notion, and they make the point that Hashem never spoke to Avraham again, but of course that doesn't, just because the Torah doesn't record something. I mean, the way the Torah works is different avos become central figures, and then we don't hear too much about the others. For example, Yitzchak was alive all through Yaakov's years in Lavan's house, and Yitzchak was alive even at the time of Mechiras Yosef. Yitzchak was aware of Yosef being sold, but Yitzchak couldn't divulge. Yitzchak is not mentioned after the blessings with Yaakov and Esau, because now it's Yaakov's story. In other words, the Torah switches the emphasis. So the fact that after the Akedah was when Avraham was 137. So Avraham lived till 175. That's another, 38
years.
The fact that we are told nothing about Avraham for the rest of the other 38 years of his life should not mean to suggest that Hashem didn't speak to him. It just means that that wasn't the focus of the history of Klal Yisrael at this point. So the truth is, therefore, that Chazal basically say that Sarah died in Hebron right after the Akedah. So it certainly was not a result of her separation from Avraham. But the question still remains, though. So what is Sarah doing in Hebron if Avraham and Yitzchak went back to Be'er Sheva? So someone will learn, some understand this, that Sarah went to look for them. In other words, they left from Be'er Sheva to go to Yerushalayim, Har HaMoriah. And Sarah is wondering where they are. Sarah may not know the mission. Because remember, Avraham presumably did not even tell Yitzchak why he's going. And we don't know if he tells Sarah or not. And she went to look for them. And since Hebron was their original home, I mean, imagine even on a superficial level, if you're looking for somebody, so one of the places you look are the old haunts. Hebron was the old haunt. Hebron was certainly a holy place. So Sarah went to Hebron looking for Avraham and Yitzchak. That is where the Satan, in the guise of an old man, told her either that Yitzchak was killed or that Yitzchak wasn't killed, depending how you learn the Midrashim, and that is where she died out of the shock. And on the way back from the Akedah, Avraham and Yitzchak were told about Sarah's death, and they buried her in the city of Hebron. In a way, of course, it was beshert. In other words, because the presumably what would have happened is, wherever Sarah died is where she would have been buried. And if Sarah would have died in Be'er Sheva, that's where she would have been buried. It was the Ratzon of Hashem that Sarah be buried in Maras HaMachpelah, and that is why Hashem created that she died there. It happens very often. Basically, people die where Hashem wants them to be. Wants them to be buried. It often happens that way.
And why people carry their bodies, to Israel when God wanted them to, Schnerzen that was buried here and not in Israel?
God wanted him
to be buried in the United States?
There's a different cheshbon. I know my Rosh Hashiva specifically instructed that he be buried in the United States because he wanted his Talmidim to be able to daven by his grave. I mean, there is a concept sometimes that a person wants to be where his Talmidim are. So that's not totally an incorrect cheshbon. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein is buried in Eretz Yisrael, although he spent most of his life either in Russia or here. But it's very interesting. People point out the significance of Avraham Avinu purchasing Maaros HaMachpelah. You know, if you go back and you look at the story, and you see that first everybody flatters Avraham, and they say, oh, you're a Nasi Elokim, you are a prince of God.
Which means you're rich too.
We will give you all the graves that you want. We will give you what you want. And then then Avraham says, well, I want one specific thing. I want the thing that Ephron has. I want that special cave. And Ephron also says, I will give it to you. And then Avraham says, no, I want to buy it. And Ephron says, well, 400 shekelim, what's the big deal? Which is an exorbitant price. So the way most of us learn, and the way Rashi learns, this is an example of Ephron with Avraham. Avraham exemplifies, we know, as Pirkei Avos says, that tzaddikim omrim ma'at v'yosin harbe, tzaddikim say very little, and they do a lot, right? Avraham says to the malachim, in last week's parsha, I'll give you a little water, little bread, and instead he gives them meat and all sorts of things. And Ephron makes grandiose promises. Ephron says, take what you want, have what you want. And then he says, by the way, there'll be a 400, you know, charge. But some of Forsham learn exactly the opposite. Some of Forsham learn, indeed, Ephron was willing to give the cave away, but he didn't want to sell it. Very interesting. Because the concept is, buying land establishes your legal ownership and entitlements. Ephron and B'nai Ches generally are willing to be generous. We're willing to say, Avraham, you want to beg, you're poor, you don't have a place to bury Sarah, we'll give it to you as a matter of charity. But Ephron did not want to legally sell land to Avraham, because that would give Avraham a sense of entitlements. So, according to this, you read the Pesukim literally, that Ephron indeed meant what he said. I will give it to you, I don't want to sell it. Avraham then insists on buying it. So Ephron mentions a price that is so high that he figures Avraham is not going to take it at all. In other words, we had a case where you're walking by with a horse and you meet a tramp. And the tramp says, how much is the horse? So you say, you figure the tramp doesn't have any money, you say, well, this horse is $5,000. So the tramp takes out a checkbook, gives you a check for $5,000, and says, take it, I want it. Now, you don't mean to sell him the horse, you want to change your mind, but a deal is a deal. Ephron picked a price that is so exorbitantly high that some of Forsham learn, again, this is not Rashi, Rashi's approach seems to be that Ephron just wanted to get the money, but some of Forsham learn that Ephron specifically did not want to sell, he basically was bluffing. And Avraham called his bluff. And then he had to go through it because it was a public, it was in front of everybody. So the concept of buying land is very, very significant. And if you look in the Torah, although our claim to Eretz Yisrael largely rests on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's promises to the Avos, there are three sections of Eretz Yisrael in which our claim is not based on religion even. Our claim is based on purchase. We bought it from the owners. One is Hebron. Not all of Hebron, but the Maaros HaMachpelah, which was purchased by Avraham in a transaction. The second is Shechem. When Yaakov returns after 34 years of absence, he buys the field of Shechem. And the third is not in the Torah, but it's the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mounts. David HaMelech bought from Aravna HaYavusi, one of the Yavusis. So it's very interesting that it's almost as if the Hashkacha knew that these would be disputed areas in which our claim to ownership would not be recognized. Maaros HaMachpelah, the Har HaBayis, and Shechem with Nablus. And yet Hashem says, therefore, I will give you an extra claim. It's not just because Hashem promised to you, but it's because you actually bought it.
But if he had a gift, he would still own it. I mean, it would be transferred to him. Why would that be less of an entitlement than buying it?
Well, the sense is that a gift could just be more of a license. You have permission to use our land, but we're not really treating you as the owner. And in that sense, too, he would always be beholden
right.
to them.
That I understand.
In the sense of beholding. And in fact, you know, what was Avraham's famous words? Avraham Avinu's famous words when he first began negotiation is ger v'toshav anochi imachem. What's a ger? I'm a stranger, and a toshav is a resident. Rav Soloveitchik used to use this phrase all the time to describe the Jew in Golus. The Jew in Golus, the Jew in America, let's say, we're a toshav, we are a resident, we are a citizen, we have rights, but we also have a sense of being a stranger in this world. We don't really belong here. both in terms of how others make us feel, and in terms of how we should feel ourselves. But keep in mind that Avraham Avinu is not talking about a Jew in Galus. Avraham Avinu is talking about a Jew in Eretz Yisrael. How many years has Avraham been in Eretz Yisrael? How many years at the time that he is saying, I am still a stranger, I am an alien, I am a foreigner? Avraham Avinu came to Eretz Yisrael at the age of 75. Sarah died at 127, so Avraham Avinu, who's 10 years older, is 137 years. So Avraham Avinu has been here, how many years? 37 and 25. So that's what? 57? That's 62 years. He's been in Eretz Yisrael 62 years. In those 62 years, he's participated in wars, right? He victoriously saved five Canaanite kings. Of course, the king of Sodom isn't around anymore, but at least in those, he saved kings from wars. He raised armies. He was very wealthy, very prosperous, etc. And yet he still says, after 62 years, more than half a century, I am a stranger. I am an alien. Right, so he recognizes you don't make it right away, right? Like you go to the South, you know, if your grandfather came from Boston, you're still a stranger there. You know, you're not really one of us, huh?
This is very natural.
Uh-huh.
A person comes to a foreign country to live up his life, he will be a stranger.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
His childhood matters.
His childhood matters. Yeah, yeah.
Of course, more than.
Even though, keep in mind though that this is more than just Stam coming to a foreign country. This is the land that Hashem had promised him too. And in fact, keep in mind, by the way, remember Rashi says on the Pasuk, Haknani Oz Be'oretz, that the Canaanites inhabited the land, Oz, then. Rashi explains that Eretz Canaan was originally given to the descendants of Shem, of which Abraham is one. The Canaanites under Nimrod and the like conquered the land of Canaan from the children of Shem, leaving certain enclaves under Semitic hands. So Malchut Tzedek, the king of Shalem, Yerushalayim, is in fact Shem. But he was like the only non-Canaanite king in Eretz Israel at the time. So in effect, Avram is really reclaiming land that belonged to his ancestors. But the Canaanites had been in possession of it for a long time. In fact, Rashi this is a question the Mefarshim asked on the first Rashi in Chumash. The first Rashi in Chumash says that why does Hashem begin with that Hashem created the world? Begin with the mitzvahs. So Rashi says, because the Canaanim will say to us, you are thieves, because you took the land away from us. So Hashem has to say that I create everything and I give it to whoever owns it. So the Mefarshim say, how can the Canaanim say to us, we were thieves, if the Canaanim stole it, not from us per se, but they stole it from the Semitic Zaro Shel Shem. I mean, it's a kasha. Because Eretz Yisrael originally belonged to the Zera of Shem. And Malchut Tzedek, who is Malchut Tzedek, the righteous king, is actually Shem ben Noach, according to Rashi. In fact, by the way, just again, the original name of Yerushalayim was Shalem. Shalem. How do you get the Yeru? Where does the Yeru come in? Right, after the Akedah, Avram calls Har HaMoria, Hashem Yireh, Hashem will see, Hashem will look down upon his people. So Yireh and Shalem, Aleph and Hey, Yud, Resh, Aleph, Hey, so Aleph and Hey equal Vav. So Yeru, Shalem. And that's why in the Tanakh, it is never called Yerushalayim. It's not even clear how that extra yud gets in there. It is always Yerushalayim. It's always written because the original name was Shalem, and Yeru is as Avraham Avinu's name of Hashem Yireh. Now, I'm going to go back to Ephron in a second, but just to clarify the notion of the two cities, you see that there are two dimensions in Yerushalayim, because Yireh refers to Hashem looking down upon us and protecting us. Shalem is the peace that human beings strive to bring out of their own interactions. So in effect, the Kadosh Baruch Hu is saying, if Yerushalayim is truly to be a repository for the divine presence, and remember the Navi Yechezkel says that Liyasid Lavo, in the future, the name of Jerusalem shall be Hashem Shama. Hashem is there. And according to Chazal, you don't only read it Hashem Shama, but Hashem Shema. Hashem is its name. The very essence of Yerushalayim will be Hashem's essence. But in order to do that, You have to combine the faith in Hashem with the shalom that human beings try to bring. Only when there's shalom and reliance on Hashem do you have that perfection. But what is the connotation of Hashem Yireh? Hashem Yireh. So here, the Midrashim have a pun. Yireh in that pasuk certainly means, the translation is, God will see, God will watch, clearly. But Yireh also means fear of Hashem. Right? So the Midrashim combine both motifs. One idea is that the Akedah was an act that in effect made no sense for Avraham Avinu. People ask the question, why is the Akedah called the sacrifice, or the Nisayon, the trial of Avraham? Why isn't it called the trial of Yitzchak? I mean, Yitzchak is asked to give up his life. Why isn't that a trial? And the answer that's always given, number one, it's easier to give your life, of course, than to kill your child. That's a very simple answer, which is nonetheless true. But number two, there's a deeper answer. And that is that for Yitzchak's personality and Yitzchak's way of serving God, sacrifice is not that much of a sacrifice. We are told that each of the Avos served Hashem in a distinctive way. Avos served Hashem through the attribute of loving kindness, preaching God's goodness, God's compassion, God's rachamim. This was his avoda, this was his connection to Hashem. And that's why Avram has to be counterbalanced by a Sarah who recognizes that there's a time for inner strength and there's a time for discipline. Right? It is Sarah that knows you have to send out Yishmael because Yishmael will corrupt Yitzchak. Avraham could not send out a Yishmael on his own because Avraham's midah is one of embracing and one of acceptance, which is all very good. But there's sometimes a line has to be drawn. And Sarah was the one who had the job of drawing that line. Yitzchak, on the other hand, we know represents what is called inner strength and determination and discipline. Unlike Avraham, who tried to reach thousands and thousands of people, most of whom fell away, by the way. Most of Avraham's geirim left. Yitzchak only had one real disciple, and that was Yaakov. Yitzchak focused inward and created gevura, inner strength, which is why, by the way, Eliezer, when he looks for a wife for Yitzchak, looks for a wife who has loving kindness.
But where do we see this gevura?
Uh-huh.
Of Yitzchak's
Well, we see it in the fact that Yitzchak was not, you see it in a negative sense, Yitzchak was not involved in creating new things. Yitzchak was involved in strengthening the existing reality. That's why the wells that he dug are the old wells of Avraham. He doesn't do any new wells. He doesn't have a nefesh or shewasu b'charan. He is not involved in going out. He never leaves Eretz Yisrael. He does not pick his own wife. Yitzchak is very self-contained. Yitzchak is within himself. Yitzchak is what you call the consolidator. Even in a successful company, right? If you look at the trajectory of business, often you'll have a person who is a great creator, creating all sorts of new projects, new ideas, but then you need somebody who can sit down and develop what is there instead of going out into new areas. And Yitzchak was the one that was designed to consolidate and hold in. And that is what we mean by gevura. Gevura doesn't mean punishment necessarily. Gevura means a withdrawal into introspection. Which is why if Avraham needs the Sarah to counterbalance his chesed with gevura, Yitzchak needs a Rivka. And Rivka's outstanding trait is her loving kindness. In fact, the Shem Shmuel says a very beautiful thing. If you, you're going to have to remind me how I got onto this because I'm losing my track here. But the Shem Mishmuel says a beautiful thought.
Shem
Mishmuel. It's a great Hasidic sefer. Shem Mishmuel says this. He says, Avraham, when was Avraham told that he would have a son from Sarah whose name should be Yitzchak? He was told this at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha when he was commanded about a bris milah at the age of 99. He was told, you will have a child through your wife Sarah, and you shall call your child Yitzchak. And if you remember, Avraham fell on his face, and he laughed. Now, Avraham then has his bris at 99. 3 days later, the malachim come in the image of people, and they tell Avraham, you're going to have a son, and Sarah overhears it behind the tent, and Sarah begins to laugh. Now, there are a lot of kashas. Why does Sarah get criticized when she laughs and Avraham didn't? I'll go into that, but I want to ask another question. I want to ask a very simple question. L'chaira, the implication of the verses are, Sarah did not hear about her having a child till the Malachim came and visited Avraham. That was 3 days after his bris, and Avraham had already been told by Hashem 3 days before. So the question is, didn't Sarah already hear about this 3 days before? In other words, why is this the first time? And I'm asking a different guy. I'm not asking about why her laughing is criticized. I'll get into that too. And why his laughing is not. I'm just asking, is this the first time Sarah hearing this news? So the Ramban actually says it is, that Avraham was too busy to give her the news. Avraham had a bris and he was... Avraham had a bris and he was not well and he was sick. He just didn't get around to telling her till the angels came. Still, that's a little bit of a dochek that he wouldn't tell her this exciting news. So the Shema Shmuel says it all comes by Hashkacha. Hashem wanted it this way. Why is this? Because we know that Avraham represents serving Hashem through loving kindness. And Sarah represents serving Hashem through gevura, inner strength and discipline, and knowing that sometimes you have to be strict and draw lines and know that not everything in the world can be legitimated and accepted. But in order for husband and wife to truly come together, although you need this counterbalancing, it's necessary for each one to incorporate the goodness that is within the other. In other words, it's necessary for the Baal Chesed to incorporate some of the strength and discipline of the Gevura, and it's necessary for the Baal Gevura, or Baal As Gevura, to incorporate some of the loving kindness of the other. And it's only when each incorporates part of the other that there can be a true unity, because when they're totally in opposites, there's not going to be a match, but each one brings out something in the other. Memela, he says the following. Bris Mila, there are a lot of ways of understanding it, but he wants to say, the Shem Shem wants to say, Bris Mila, in effect, is teaching Avraham something about Gevura. Because what does Bris Mila say? Bris Mila says, you take something, you cut it away, and you reject it. You throw it out. Avraham's nature is, why should I throw away the Orla? I mean, let me take that which is bad and elevate it, and work with it, and improve it, like I pray for Sodom. One of the lessons of Bris Mila is that there are certain types of evil that you have to separate from and throw away. It was a lesson in the notion of Gevura on a symbolic level. So Avram was not ready to make a shidduch with Sarah until he incorporated some of Sarah's Gevura, which symbolically came to him through his understanding of the commandment of circumcision, which is chituch. What is the orla? The orla is that part of a person that is treated as despised and rejected. And Avraham is told, there are things in your life that you have to reject. You can't be all embracing. And Fakert, the opposite, Sarah doesn't hear about that she's going to have a child till she follows in Avraham's ways and serves food to the guests, which is an act of loving kindness. Hachnasas Orchim. So Sarah has to hear about Yitzchak through an act of chesed. And Avraham hears about Yitzchak through an act of gevura. So when Avraham incorporates the midah of gevura, and Sarah incorporates the midah of chesed, now they are ready to come together and produce a child. Now, granted, Yitzchak incorporated more of Sarah than Avraham, because Yitzchak was the gevura, but in terms, I think the insight, although the Shema Shmuel does not apply to marriage in general, he just applies it to the avos. But I think what he's saying is something that has a tremendous amount of validity in a marriage generally, that the concept of opposites attracting, which has a validity, isn't simply opposites attracting, but rather within a human being there's a tremendous diversity of emotion and ability. But we tend to become focused in moving in one track only, and many other facets of our midos become dormant and not used, and the function of the intimacy in a relationship is that we become more whole as different parts of our personalities develop that would otherwise not do so. And this is what he's saying, that Avraham needed that gevura, Sarah needed that chesed, and that's how they come out. Now, if you could nudge me back on my track here, what...
you know, but his hat is cold.
That's what you were talking about.
Okay, right.
Why was,
right.
Is the Akeda called a Nisa?
Right, so I'm going to go back to that. All
and
right.
You were talking about the three different Midos, but you got to Yitzchak and you didn't get to Yaakov.
Yeah, okay, now Yaakov, the Midah of Yaakov, just finished that. Yaakov is considered to be a combination of Avraham and Yitzchak, and that's called Tiferes. Avraham is Chesed, Yitzchak is Gevura, Yaakov is Tiferes, which is beauty. John Keats said the same thing. Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty, because the other word for tiferes is emes. That truth requires the ability to consolidate and integrate chesed and gevura. And this is why Avraham had a Yishmael, because too much chesed leads to one type of destruction. And Yitzchak had an Esav, too much gevura leads to another type of destruction. It is only Yaakov who successfully integrated the midos of chesed and gevura in Taso Shlema, that all of his children are members of Klal Yisrael. Well, at least with Avram and Yitzchak, we can see a fairly clear complementary idea that
right.
Avram is chesed, Sarah gevura. Yitzchak is gevura, Rivka is chesed. Now, with Rachel and Leah, it's a little bit more difficult because Yaakov himself is already considered to have embodied the synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to identify exactly what the different midas are. We have to think about that a little bit more when we get to those parshiyos.
So why Yitzhak was called Pahad Yitzhak? Whenever Yitzhak was mentioned, is Pahad Yitzhak.
Well, Pahad, which is fear, reverence, that is the stance of a person who contains himself. See, Chesed is associated with serving God out of love. When you serve God out of love, you want to do. Gevura is the one who serves God out of reverence and awe. So you restrain yourself from any type of misbehavior. So Pachad Yitzchak means that Yitzchak's relationship to God was one of awe and great, great reverence. That's why it's...
Okay, so you're saying, Yira?
Well, the difference in Pachad and Yira is that we say Yira is Meirachok. Yira is when there's a distance. And Pachad is when the lion is right on top of you. Yitzchak's sense of Hashem was so palpable that it was like Hashem was right with him.
Sorry, did you say Yitzchak was he too much chesed or going on?
Not that he was too much chesed, but rather a parent who exhibits too much chesed will wind up having a child like Yishmael. In other words,
what was wrong with Yishmael?
Well, Yishmael was not a Yitzchak, certainly. Yishmael was a Rasha for a lot of his life.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that the Chachamim do say Yishmael eventually did some type of tshuva. But still, I mean, Yishmael did not grow up to become the righteous person that
but
Yitzchak
you can't
was.
Compare Yishmael to Esav. Esav has both parents.
That's
are
right.
Jews, and,
which by the way teaches us,
God.
Which by the way therefore teaches us maybe that although too much love without discipline can be destructive, but it's less destructive than too much discipline without love. I mean, you're right. That's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
That if the ace, in other words, if Yishmael is not so good, Esav is worse. So indeed we see that the gevura without the chesed, if you had to make a choice, the gevura without the chesed is more destructive than the chesed without the, although they're both destructive, you need a balance. And Chazal encapsulate this. Chazal actually say in the Maimer Chazal that the meaning, how do you raise a child? They give you a very express formula. Yamin mikareves, with your right hand you draw near. The right hand is the stronger hand for non-lefties. And the small, and with the left hand, which is the weaker hand, you push away. There has to be discipline. There has to be richuk. There has to be sitting and law drawing. But that should be the weaker elements. And the stronger element should be the yamin. The yamin is mekarevis. Psychologists say, again, I don't think you can quantify this, but they say that in terms of interactions, they give like a 75-25%, that the number of things you say to your child every day, 75 should be positive, and try to have no more than 25 negative. Of course, it depends on the child, I guess, but that's what you try. So the truth of the matter is, if you follow yourself around and you record what we say in a typical day, we might find sometimes the ratios may actually be reversed, and it's something to be conscious of. Because, you know, think about an adult. You know, it happens to everybody. You go to work one day and somebody just criticizes you. You know, somebody says, you know, what a lousy report this was. You know, it eats at you the whole, I mean, I know myself, it can eat at you the entire day, the entire week, entire month, whatever it is. And that's one thing that somebody says to you. And yet, we think, you know, our kids are less immune to that, so we could say all sorts of things. And, you know, we don't realize that how biting and hurtful criticism can sometimes be. So, of course, you have to offer it, right? We read in the Haftarah. In fact, keep in mind the Haftarah this week. Talk about Adoniyahu, who was David's son, who wanted to rebel against David and take the kingdom against Shlomo. And what does the Pasuk say? The Pasuk says very, very specifically, what was Adoniyahu's problem? Lo atzavo aviv miyamav. His father never wanted to make him unhappy, never give him any tzara. So, you know, so the Torah is warning us that indeed, be careful about that. And in fact, one of the connections to the Haftorah is that the great thing about tzara was tzara knew when to draw the line, and it's contrasting it in the Haftorah. But still, it has
so
to be...
So why is the Rabbi criticizing Sarah and not Hagar?
Not Hagar?
Yes, yeah. They're criticizing that why Sarah treated Hagar that way, chased her out and...
Well, actually, who criticizes her? The Chachamim consider her actions correct.
Right.
I mean, what I'm saying, modern literary theorists who like to portray the Avos and the Imahos as a dysfunctional family who couldn't get along, like to take that tack. But in Chazal recognize this as one of the Nisyonos of Avram, that Avram had a test. Would he be able to send Hagar away? Excuse me. And of course, at the end, by the way, Avraham remarried Hagar. She was Keturah, and he had children with her, and Yishmael did Shuvah. It has a very happy ending, but it was recognized in Yitzchak's formative years.
But you say Hosif. Why do you say Hosif? Which means it's not.
Well,
it's not Hagar.
Yeah. Well, he had sent. I mean, the pasuk is
and so many children. How Hagar can have so many children afterwards, one after the other, when she was already.
No, obviously there are miracles. If Sarah has a child at 90, that's a miracle too. Isaac recorded. Well, the Ibn Ezra says sometimes that Hashem does not record the secondary miracles. In other words, if because of Sarah, a blessing of fertility came into the world, there may have been a lot of beneficiaries, right? Rashi says a lot of barren women.
Miracle happens to good things, but not miracle to happen. He sent them away, and he's...
he sent them away, but they're still the children of Avraham. The children of Keturah are Chayiv and Bris Mila. They have to have circumcision. When it says he gave them gifts...
Yes.
So according to some Midrashim, it means he gave them certain wisdom that Avraham had. And he says he sent them to the east. So some say the oriental wisdom. Some say these nations became the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese and the Vietnamese, and all of the various wisdoms like acupuncture and the yin and the yang and the various forms of meditation. Some say this was a Yerusha that Avraham had given the Bnei Keturah. So there's a lot of, they're not Jews, but there's a lot of Chachma. This Chachma came from Avraham. Yeah, yeah.
And here you're saying it was only after the Lachim came that she did this act of chesed, and somehow that doesn't fit into the kind of.
I think we have to be absolutely certain that this is not the first act of Hachnasas Orchin that Sarah ever did in her life. But I think the Shem Shmuel is just saying it would have been inappropriate for Sarah to get the news via the mitzvah of Bris Mila, because Bris Mila is an act of Gevurah. So it had to wait until the next opportunity for Chesed. So the next opportunity was 3 days later. For the first 3 days, there were no Orchim for the first 2 days. So we're not saying that this was the first Chesed, but rather she had to come at it through doing Chesed and not through the mitzvah of Gevurah.
I think it's Rashi who says that Sarah did the women and
the men.
Yes, but even so, her method was different. In fact, it's very interesting. The relationship of Sarah and Avraham is very, very different than the relationship of Yitzchak and Rivka. It's very different. You see that Sarah was much more of a co-equal say. When there's a problem with the children, the good son and the bad son, Sarah has no hesitation. She tells Avraham, this is what we have to do. Avraham doesn't want to do it, and Hashem tells Avraham, listen to your wife, she's correct. Now with Yitzchak and Rivka, which is almost the same type of problem, because the good son and the bad son, so to speak, the only way that Yitzchak is able, the only way that Rivka is able to deal with the matter is by subterfuge and disguise and masquerade. Now, there are a lot of reasons you can give to this. First of all, Esav is her own son. Maybe the dynamic is different than with the Yishmael. But the Nitziv, and I wouldn't say this if the Nitziv would say it, it's almost too Bill Moyer-ish, as it were, to use that. But the Nitziv says this. The Nitziv says that Rivka was in awe of Yitzchak. Yitzchak, number one, was a korban. He had been sanctified as an altar, as a korban. His face shone with a special kedusha. Rivka also was married at a very young age. right? She was married at 3 years old, according to one interpretation. According to the other interpretation, 14 years old, which is still relatively young. Yitzchak was 40, so he was very much an older man. Yitzchak was much more removed from the world anyway. He was a person of great spiritual introspection. And the Netziv frankly says that she had difficulty communicating to him things directly. And therefore, what she wanted to do is, she wanted him to realize, right? Part of the stratagem was she should realize through this whole thing that Esav was not proper. And ultimately, it was his decision. She could never make a demand upon him. So the Netziv actually says that Rivka was much more in awe of Yitzchak than was Sarah of Avraham. Sarah was the kind of the co-equal partner, and Rivka always regarded herself as very much subordinate to the holiness of Yitzchak. Because again, Yitzchak is really the most mysterious of our avos. We are given the least biographical detail of him, but that goes back to the fact of that Gevura is inner, and Gevura is restraint, and Gevura is sinias, etc. Although, what do the Chachamim say? The Chachamim say that it's Yitzchak that is going to save all of us from Gehenna. Gemara has a story that at some point, even Avraham is going to say to Hashem, in other words, Hashem is going to tell Avraham, your children are sinning, what do you want me to do about it? So Avraham says, well, if they're sinning, you know, get somebody else, you know, maybe it's time to get somebody else. And even with Yaakov, Yitzchak is the one Av that is going to fight for us. We're not sure exactly,
you know,
what critical point that is, but he's the one that's going to raise.
You know, we say that Abraham was the Ole, the first Ole,
right.
And Yitzhak was the first Sabra,
yeah.
And Yaakov was the Yored, the first Yored.
For sure, Yored. Well, that's right. That's right. Abraham went to Mitzrayim, but he came back.
Came back, right.
And Yaakov didn't come back till after he died.
Right.
Well, that's,
but Yitzhak never left.
Yitzhak was not allowed to leave, right? Yitzhak was a korban. Yeah. So there is a machlokas according to the Rambam. The Rambam says specifically, see, Yishmael is not considered a child of Avraham anymore. Because when it says, Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei l'chazar, it is through Yitzchak that you have children. Yishmael is not considered, halachically, a descendant of Avraham. And therefore, the B'nai Yishmael, although Islamic practice, see, this is a misconception a lot of Jews have. It's true that Islam practices circumcision, but there's no halacha to that effect. Halachically, they are not considered descendants of Avraham. They don't have to have a bris. However, the Rambam does paskin the descendants of Keturah, other than Yishmael. In other words, all those children at the end of Parshas Vayera, Midyan, etc., do have to have a bris. And the Rambam says they have to have a bris not at age 13, like Yishmael. They have to have a bris at the age of eight days. Now, the Rambam then says, since we don't know who the B'nai Keturah are today, and they have intermarried over time with the B'nai Yishmael, who are the Arabs, the Rambam says, halachically, all Arabs must have circumcision at 8 days old. That's what the Rambam said, which is not the Islamic practice. Islamic practice 13. Does it at 13 like Yishmael. But the Rambam says, B'nai Yishmael technically are not chayev in Bris Mila. B'nai Keturah are, and since we don't know who are B'nai Keturah or B'nai Yishmael, so in a Jewish society, so to speak, if we had jurisdiction to impose religious law, they would have to circumcise at 8 days. No, Esav is not, because we darshin ki ba Yitzchak. Ba Yitzchak means part of Yitzchak and not all of Yitzchak. Therefore, B'nai Yishmael is excluded, and of Yitzchak it is only Zerah Yaakov. In other words, we exclude two exclusions. We exclude Yishmael from Zerah Avraham, and we exclude Esav as Yitzchak's children. Actually, there's an interesting halachic question, and this is two nuschas in the Rosh Hashanah davening. It's clear from the Gemara that Yishmael is excluded as a child of Avraham, and Esav is excluded as a grandson of Avraham. But the question is Esav excluded as a child of Yitzchak? And there's a machlokas. This is reflected in the Rosh Hashanah davening. At the end of the bracha of Zichronos, That's the blessing in the Musaf that deals with remembering. So it says, Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak, Lizaro Hayom, to his children, today on Rosh Hashanah, Barachamim Tiskor, may you remember the merit of the binding of Yitzchak. Now there are two nuschais, there are two texts in the Matzah. One text is, remember the merit of the Akedah to the children of Yitzchak. But some say, don't say that, because the children of Yitzchak, that's going to include Esav. We don't want Esav to get the benefit of the Akedah. So in some Machzorim it says, Akedas Yitzchak Lizaro Shel Yaakov Barachamim Tiskor. Remember the sacrifice of Yitzchak to the descendants of Yaakov. Why do you say the descendants of Yaakov? Because you don't want to say, remember the Akedah to the descendants of Yitzchak, because that would include Esav. So, according to that reading, Esav is included as a descendant of Yitzchak. But our standard machzor, if you take the standard machzor, I believe we just say, remember the Akedah to Yitzchak's descendants, because we consider Esav excluded from that as well. So that's a machlokas. But it is pashut that Esav is not considered a descendant of Avraham for purposes of halacha. Okay. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little about Rivka being tested as opposed to when Yaakov saw Rachel, no test at all.
Right. I'll come back. Let me just get I'm bringing up different things and I get.
Sorry.
No. I'll get back to it. So I just wanted to say like this. I'm going to go back to Har Moriah. I promise you, and Yerushalayim, because that's why I get into this. And that is, if each of the Avos had this different way of serving Hashem, that is why the Nisayon always calls upon them to do the opposite of what their natural propensity is. The trials of Avraham involve going against Chesed, sending away Yishmael, leaving his elderly father. Lech Lecha is a Nisayon, right? The Akedah. And that's why the Akedah is not a Nisayon of Yitzchak. Because for Yitzchak to give his life for God, that's what Yitzchak does. But for Avraham, who teaches the idea of loving kindness and compassion and benevolence, for Avraham Avinu to kill his son, in effect, Avraham is saying, everything I've believed about Hashem is false. My life has been a lie. Everything I've taught about Hashem is no longer true. That's a shattering realization. And that's why the Sfas Emes says, why does Hashem say after the Akedah, now I know that you fear Hashem? Why doesn't he say, now I know that you love Hashem? Because loving is higher than fear. Because the answer is that you can't really love something that is so foreign to everything you understand. But Avraham Avinu's greatness was that even when he didn't feel that love of Hashem, he could act anyway. It's true that loving Hashem is higher than fearing Hashem. But what happens when you don't get that excitement? What happens if you don't get that joy? What happens if the mitzvahs are not turning you on, so to speak, and they don't give you a sense of closeness with Hashem? He didn't feel close to Hashem at that moment, because this is not the Hashem that he understood. That's the meaning. Vayares ha-makom me-rachok. He saw the place from a distance, but we know that makom is also a name for Hashem. God was far from him. But that's the strength, that's the rock bottom, that even when God is far, it doesn't make sense. You're not being spiritually elevated, so you speak. You do it anyway, because you have to do it. And that's why it's called Yira. And therefore, the Mefarshim say, Hashem called Mount Moriah, Hashem Yira, is a pun. Number one, Hashem Yira means God will always look at us and protect us. But also because Yira, that what Avraham did represents the fear of Hashem, not the love of Hashem. And in fact, Hashem Yireh also means that we don't understand what goes on in this world. Hashem Yireh, Hashem understands, not me. See, look at the whole pasuk. Asher Yeyomer Hayom, Bahar Hashem Yeroyah. Let's translate the pasuk. Avram called the mountain, God sees, or God will see. Asher Yeyomer Hayom, it will be said at some future day, on that mountain, God will be seen. You see what Avraham is saying? Avraham is saying, in this world, I cannot claim to understand the ways of God. They are mysterious. They are beyond me. I have no idea why there would ever be such a command. Only God knows. But there will come a day, and that day is referred to by Yom Ahu, the day of Mashiach, the day of redemption, that God will not only see, but God will be perceived. God will be seen. We will understand this at the end of time.
That's why Hashem calls Avraham Yireh Elokim Atah.
Yes.
He doesn't say that for any other Nisayon.
That's right, that's right. Because this was the one time in Avraham's life when he can only act out of Yireh. He could not act out of Ava. And the greatness of Avraham is that even though he wasn't feeling the Ava, he forced himself to act anyway. He forced himself to act. And, you know, we can look at that and say, well, that's not the highest level because it wasn't, you know, with, and of course it wasn't with enthusiasm. It wasn't forcing oneself, and as he did it with enthusiasm, he did it with, but it wasn't something, his heart was not in it. I mean, he didn't want to kill his son.
He was confused, right?
I will do it. I will do it if this is what you want. I will do it. And that's where Yireh can step in, where Ava does not step in. Because Yireh says, even if I don't feel this is a good thing, I will do it anyway because this is Hashem. And of course, many say that the Nisayon of the Akedah was, how did Avraham know that this was Hashem's true will? See, in other words, you might say, it's not a Nisayon. If I knew that God wanted me to do this, so I'll do it. But how do you know, right? I mean, we have people. It's a hard question. We have people who are in jail for killing, because they were told, they said they heard a voice from God that told them to do it, right? And we call them, that's a hallucination. They're crazy, whatever it is. How does Avraham know that he's not crazy? How does Avraham know? And wouldn't it be easier for him to say, I must be crazy? So some say that was the Nisayon, that Avraham had internal validators, of which we really don't know what they were, but a prophet knows when he's getting the real message and when he's not getting the real message. And the Nisayon of Avraham was not to construe the real thing as a fake thing. In other words, because his own self-interest would have tainted him and moved him in that direction. So many say the Nisayon was not in doing it. The Nisayon was in not allowing his personal interest to misinterpret this as a hallucination or the like.
I've always heard that another view of the Akedah is that it was one against child sacrifice at the time. I mean, Avraham was going around saying, don't sacrifice your children. The test was then that.
Yeah.
And I've been preaching, don't do this, and now I have
yes.
to do it.
Yes.
So, and that he worked. The question is, when I learned that, it's something that he actually worked himself into the frenzy that people normally had in doing a child sacrifice, and the test was actually to stop.
Yeah. Rav Cook says, and this is an interesting point that a lot of people don't emphasize. When we look at the Akedah, the thing we tend to focus on almost exclusively is the willingness to go ahead and do the act, right? To showing Avraham's devotion to Hashem. And that's certainly a dimension. However, we don't pay a lot of attention to the implications of God telling him not to do it. Like, what is the meaning of God telling him not to do it? And Rav Cook says that is also exactly what you're saying. That is also a very significant lesson that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling you, that I want you to have the passion where you'll do anything for God that God asks you to do. But I also want you to know, this is not the way I want you to serve me. In other words, there is a lesson in the stopping as well. And as you say, according to some midrashim, Avraham was so involved, apparently this was almost like a hypnotic type of thing, that he almost had difficulty stopping. And yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, take that enthusiasm and that passion and use it to serve me, but not in these destructive ways. And Rav Cook points out that in the ancient world, in Avraham's time, it was thought that you either had a certain coldness towards God, where you weren't involved, or if you were involved, you had to give your whole life, your whole child. And Hashem wanted to bring Avraham to that climactic ecstasy, as it were, and then pull him away from the brink and say, you've achieved that emotion, but don't use it in this particular way. So it is important, a very important lesson, that there is not only a lesson in what Avraham was willing to do, but there's also a lesson in what he was told not to do at the end.
But how does it play into the bracha that Hashem gave Avraham in terms of his zera? Did Avraham play the guitar?
Well, you know, here you have a big problem. I mean, you have a big problem because if you remember, Rashi said, Avraham started asking Hashem questions after Hashem called it off. Whether it was after the Malach called it off, Avraham then said, okay, now that it's over, I have a question. And he says, you promised me, right, I'll have a child from Sarah, and now you're telling me to shecht him and slaughter him. How are you going to keep your promise? Now, he didn't raise this question initially. And if you remember, Hashem gave him an answer, and Hashem's answer was, almost you might say a Clinton-esque answer, well, I didn't say to slaughter him. I said, put him on the altar. And you did. Now, the one thing I think is very certain. It's obviously very clear that it's not that Avraham misunderstood Hashem. In other words, if Hashem didn't mean to sacrifice Yitzchak in the first place, then what's the nisayon? You're praising Avraham because he misunderstood and he got it wrong? Obviously, Hashem meant for Avraham to understand that Yitzchak should be slaughtered, and he wanted to see if Avraham would do it without raising questions. But Hashem worded it in such a way that Hashem could later say, I didn't contradict myself. But it's certainly, I don't think it's possible to understand the Akedah as Avraham misunderstanding Hashem's Tzivui. Because then, first of all, what would have been the point of Hashem saying that unless Hashem knew he would misunderstand it? I mean, if Hashem would tell Avram, put him on the altar and take him off, what type of nisayon is that? It's not a nisayon.
But you know, Yitzhak asked him, where is the lamb? We are going to sacrifice. Where is the lamb? Yeah. So Abraham told him, God will show.
That's right. So that's also Hashem Yireh, like the same, also, which is another, yeah. But it is said that Yitzchak understood. I mean, Rashi points out that Yitzchak understood. That's why it repeats, V'yelchu shneim yachdav, they both walked together, that even after Yitzchak understood, he continued to walk.
Why did Hashem send the malach? Why did Hashem himself?
Yes, yeah, so there's a good word about that. They tell it through a story. When the Hasidic movement began, at the time of the Baal Shem Tov, if you recall, the Vilna Gaon was very much against Hasidus. He thought they were breaking halachas, etc. They were de-emphasizing learning of Torah. So he wanted to put a ban in Lithuania against Hasidus. And particularly, the target, by the way, was Chabad, because Chabad was the only Hasidus in Lithuania. And at that time, the first Rebbe was the Baal HaTanya, was a great, great Gadol B'Torah. I mean, the Baal HaTanya is quoted in the Mishnah Berurah all the time. And he wanted to meet with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon refused to meet with him. He refused. And I know some Misnagdim in Baltimore who still feel that the Vilna Gaon's Cheirim is still in effect. Is it? Okay. Vilna Gaon. But anyway, so at one point they were circulating an excommunication, and they went to a great, great Gadol in Germany, Rev. Feil, who was the Rev. of Hamburg, he was called Rev. Feil Hamburger. And they said, because Vilna Gaon signs on the ban, and the Vilna Gaon is like a Malach Hashem Tzavakos. He's like an angel of God, like we often talk about very great people, as like being a Malach. He says, you know, when Hashem told Avraham to take his son as a korban, Hashem spoke to Avraham directly. And when Hashem says, don't kill him, it's V'yikrei Lav Malach Hashem, there was a Malach. What's the difference? You see from here an important lesson. That in order to kill somebody, to destroy somebody, only Hashem can give you the command. You don't listen to Malachim. When it comes to saving somebody, a Malach is good enough. So he says, you want me to destroy a movement of Jews? A Malach isn't good enough. I have to hear it from Hashem. That's what he said. So don't tell me the Vilna Gaon is a Malach. But okay, but...
What did he have against the Chabad? Why did they?
Well, it wasn't particularly against Chabad, and don't confuse it with the Chabad issues today. The problem of the Hasidic movement, right? Why did the Hasidic movement begin? Because the Baal Shem Tov taught there were many Jews who were not learned, and they felt they were second-class citizens, and their worship of Hashem was not treasured. So the Hasidus tried to build up the common person, the person who was not learned, by emphasizing serving Hashem through prayer and loving kindness and singing and dancing, etc., and through joy. And the Vilna Gaon felt that this would be ultimately demeaning of this feeling so much that they were de-emphasizing practical halacha. So they were saying, for example, that it's so important to daven to Hashem in an inspired way that if you're not inspired in the morning to daven shacharis, don't daven shacharis until the afternoon. If you're not ready for the Pesach Seder until Chol HaMoed, you know, make your Seder Chol HaMoed. In other words, they were stressing the kavana more than the action. And the Vilna Gaon thought this was very dangerous. But many Hasidim say that as a result of the Vilna Gaon's prestige, that forced the movement to be more mainstream in terms of halacha. Now, of course, by and large, in most respects, Hasidim are more meticulous in mitzvahs than none. But at some point, that wasn't always the case. Well, certainly, Hasidus was certainly a movement of inclusion and of chesed and the like. Although today it's very interesting, Hasidus often is portrayed by people as excluded. You're part of a group or not, you know, it depends on which movement, etc. Hasidim today may resemble the Misnagdim of 200 years ago. Okay. So everything gets... What do they say once? The Chafetz Chaim, much later, Chafetz Chaim is this century, befriended, although he was from Lithuania, he befriended many Hasidic groups. So somebody once said, you know, how are you befriending these people who are so against what the Vilna Gaon taught about Torah and everything else? So the Chafetz Chaim used to tell this story about a rich man, who had two sons-in-law, two daughters who got married, and he was supporting his two sons-in-law. And one he would support, he would give them two or three meals a day, and one would be milchiks, and one would be fleishiks. One would be the best cheese and butter and bread, and the other would have the best meat. And they used to argue about, you know, who was getting the more favorable treatment. And one day the person got, and you know, they were always fighting over, you know, who is the better son-in-law, who is the more learned one. But eventually the father-in-law got very poor. So he was unable to support his two sons-in-law with anything specific. He says, I can't give you food anymore, I can't give you milchiks or fleishiks, but here, you can get the milchik pots and you can get the fleishik pots. And then you make your own food. So they were still fighting about who was the more prestigious. So the father-in-law said, listen, you know, and I used to give you real milk and real meat so you could argue which is better. But now a milchik pot, a fleishik pot, it's all the same. Right. So the Chafetz Chaim said, when there used to be real misnagdim who would be learning Torah the whole day, like the Vilna Gaon, and real chassidim who would have fiery enthusiasm in prayer, we could debate which is the better derech, which is the good derech, we could criticize. Now we're all parf. Now, you know, the chassidus have, you know, a little bit of a milchik pot, and the misnagdim a little bit of a fleishik pot. He says there's no real point in arguing who's better, because we're all so far removed from what the ideal is that, you know, there's no real machlokas anymore. That gave up?
They gave up. There was a big rebellion. Those who didn't study long enough.
Right.
I mean, I have had people ask me, well, don't Orthodox Jews have to do this? No, no, no.
Yeah,
no,
well,
no.
It's...
For the most part, the other people say, oh, well, it's such a great and vibrant movement, and they're really just going to throw up halacha.
Well.
And they went down.
Well, there were, you know, again, I mean... Every lie has a kernel of truth. I mean, there were isolated segments in early Hasidus. They didn't want to throw off halacha. They were not reforming anyway. But they felt that the inner feeling is so important that you could dispense with certain details. And this is why the Vilna Gaon reacted so strongly against it. And basically, because of the Vilna Gaon, by and large, that tendency was that's where Hasidus developed. Except occasionally, you still see today, in Zmanei Tefila, there's sometimes some movements... That's still, but even that's a minority within Hasidus. That's not necessarily all that common. But that's probably the only area in which there might be any possible laxity for that. But anyway, that's what I'm saying. So this is why the Akedah is the Nisayon of Avraham, because it requires him to go against his Mida of loving kindness, his Mida of Chesed. It's not called the Nisayon of Yitzchak, and that is why some midrashim say, why didn't Sarah go on the Akedah? Why did she come up? He says the opposite. Because Sarah would have made it easier, the opposite of what you would think. Sarah would have made it easier for Avram to do that job. Sarah would have given the Gevurah, and Hashem wanted Avram to be able to summon it up on his own.
Did Sarah have her own personal faith?
Not that I know, you know, I'm not aware of it in particular.
She had a touch with
Yitzchak. Well, I mean, it could be, you know, it could very well be that the fact that she was Megayeres, she was actively involved in being Makarev, maybe that was a test. Mm-hmm. Maybe that wasn't her nature. Mm-hmm. And she did it anyway. She, mm-hmm. Her whole life of being Osik and Gemilas Kasadit, which is good. You know, Mark Twain actually writes in one of his writings that he feels there's no such thing as an altruistic personality, because people who do nice things to others get satisfaction out of it. So you're serving yourself. Mark Twain says the only person who's a genuine Baal Chesed is one who hates doing good things for other people and does them anyway. That is a Baal Chesed, because they get no satisfaction out of it. Now again, I don't think we could speak this way about Sarah, but it could very well be that you know, it was something against her nature that she said it was good and right and she'll do it. Rav Moshe used this. Rav Moshe Feinstein said on himself that by nature he had a very bad temper. I'm not sure if that's even true, but that's what he said. By nature he was very quick to anger, but he says he worked on himself, because Rav Moshe was someone who never got angry. But he said that was not a natural endowment. And the truth is, this is really a problem with a lot of biographies of Gedolim. Rav Hutner used to point this out, that when you read the biographies of the great rabbis, they always seem to be so perfect from the time they were born. You know, at 4 years old, they know Shas, etc. But in reality, sometimes if we would read about the imperfections and the struggles and the fact that they worked on themselves to achieve Midos, that's something that's very inspiring, because that's something we can look at and say, oh, I have, the Chafetz Chaim had a problem with Lashon Hara when he was young, you know. It's something that we can learn. We can learn much more from the obstacles that people surmount than from the perfection.
Is there any good biographies
out there? Well, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is a very good biography. Yeah, the article of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky is a very nice one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what the... That's right, that's right. Well, that's why I'm saying if you accept this thought, you're going to have to interpret that she died, like I mentioned before, not because she thought he was killed, but because she thought Avram failed the test. Some learned the other way. He failed to do it. Yeah. Yeah.
And he said to him, you know, you gave Abraham everything, and that's why he's so great.
Right.
He loves you, but now he's giving this up.
Right.
But if you take it away from him, if you continue to love
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
It's like
and
Job.
And that's when it came by.
Yeah.
How can he understand all that, you know, this whole challenge,
Well, this goes back, of course, you know, the book of Eev is the same story. You know, this goes back to the Ramban's comment of Nisayan, Elokim Nisa es Avraham. Right? So the Ramban raises the fundamental question, Hashem knows the future, right? Hashem knows the future. So what's the concept of a test? A teacher tests a student because we're uncertain what the student knows. Hashem knows. So the Ramban makes the important point that every Nisayan is Latovas HaManusa. Every Nisayan is for the benefit not of the tester, but of the tested, and that is lahotzi min hakoach el hapoel, that people have potentialities, but unless those potentialities are actualized, they remain dormant. In other words, the Avraham who would have sacrificed Yitzchak is not the same person as the Avraham who actually was willing to carry it out and did carry it out. So the concept is this. When we talk about the Satan, you know, we're not talking about bets here. Even in the book of Eev, we're not talking about a game where I bet you if you give him this, he's not going to pass. But really, the Satan is doing God's work here. You know, the Satan is an agent of Hashem. You know, what does it say? That the Satan's job is to give us free choice and give us the nisyonos in life for which we can be triumphant. In fact, when somebody said this in the Gemara, the Satan went and kissed them, said, nobody's ever said anything nice about me before. So, the concept of the Satan is saying, if you want Avram to truly be a righteous person, we have to see if he's able to do this Nisayan. So it's to transform Avraham by his willingness to do this. But you know, there are Mefarshim, if you look at the word when Sarah died, it does say, Libchosa. He came, what does it say? Lispod l'Sarah, to eulogize Sarah, for Libchosa, and to cry over Sarah. Now, the two words are used, Bechi and Hesped, crying and eulogizing. Now, normally, crying comes first, right? Crying is the first thing that hits you. And then he says, eulogize and then cry. So the Mefarshim say a nice thought. And that is, very often, the first crying that we have is often a sense of guilt or a lack of closure. A person thinks, if only I did this, if only I did this, if only we made up, if only, you know, we didn't leave each other in anger. So that's crying, that's bechi, that's bechi. With Avraham Avinu, there was no sense of unfinished business. The relationship, everything had meshed. There had been a closure, there had been a completion. The crying is simply recognizing the great loss of Sarah in terms of the spiritual gift she gave to the world and she brought to his life. So that's a function of hesped. Hesped, eulogy, is when you think about what the person's life was, you think about the goodness, you think about their contribution, and then you cry. So for most people, there is the crying that results from the guilt, etc. And then there is the hesped that talks about the greatness of the person. With Avraham, the crying totally came from the greatness that wasn't here anymore. It didn't come from any other extraneous factor. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said at his wife, Slavaya, one of the truly, truly most amazing statements. They were married, I think 50 years, or maybe even over 50 years. And he said, it is customary at a Levaya to ask mechila, you know, for your spouse. But he says, in all of our years, neither of us ever did anything to the other, for which we have to ask mechila. I have to ask forgiveness, nice. And therefore I don't have to ask mechila. In 50 years, that's what he said. And, you know, he didn't have, if it wouldn't be true, you didn't have to say it. And so that is somewhat what we're saying with Avraham. That with Avraham, the crying was just the grief of Sarah not being here. It was not for any other extraneous point. But there is a small chaf in Libkosa. Libkosa, the chaf is small. And why is the chaf small? So the Baal HaTurim says, because his crying was not total, he held himself in a little bit. Why would he hold himself in a little bit? So some of the Bali Musar say this, that when you do a great mitzvah, and the Yetzer Hara tries to discourage you from doing the mitzvah, and if the Yetzer Hara fails, the next thing it'll do is make you feel bad for doing it. Meaning if the Yetzer Hara cannot stop you from doing a mitzvah, the second thing it'll try to do is make you regret the fact that you did the mitzvah. Kind of a negative tshuva. So he says, given the fact that Chazal say that Sarah died as a result of the Akedah, you might think that if Avram lets himself totally go into grieving for Sarah, it may turn into, why did I ever get involved in that Akedah that resulted in Sarah's death? And Chas v'Shalom, it would be the Maisa of the Yetzer Hara that would regret the supreme mitzvah that he did for Hashem. And therefore he knew that letting his emotions be open too much would lead him into a very dangerous second guessing of the Akedah experience. So he didn't let himself go all the way. He says he actually contained himself in that sense, recognizing that he's not going to be mischaret over that. But al pi halacha, there's a halachic interpretation that's given, which again is homiletical, but it's instructive in terms of halacha. When did the Akedah take place? So most midrashim say the Akedah took place on Rosh Hashanah. But there's a minority view that the Akedah took place on Yom Kippur. It was actually Yom Kippur. So let's go with the view that took place on Yom Kippur. So that's the 10th of Tishrei. Now, the trip home is 3 days, because it took 3 days there. Now, presumably, since Hara Moriah is the site of the temple, when you go to the Beis Hamikdash, you always have to spend the night. You can't bring a korban and then leave the same day. So presumably, they stayed the 10th. So they started traveling the 11th of Tishrei. So the 11th, the 12th, 13th of Tishrei, they traveled. They got to where they had to go, the Chevron and the 14th. So Sarah was buried Erev Sukkos, according to this Cheshvan. See, 14th of Tishrei. Now, what's the halacha if Chas v'Shalom you bury somebody Erev Yom Tov? So the halacha is you don't have to sit a whole Shiva. It is that portion of the day that counts for Shiva. And how do you calculate Shloshim, the 30 days of mourning? Well, that little bit counts for 7 days. 7 days of Sukkos count for another 7 days. It counts towards the Shloshim. Shmini Atzeres is a separate holiday. Therefore, Shmini Atzeres equals 7 days. That's just Shmini Atzeres. This is Eretz Yisrael. There's no Simchas Torah. So, in effect, the following. If you bury a mace Erev Sukkos, you only have to keep 9 days after Shmini Atzeres to get your shloshim, get your 30 days of mourning. You see why? Because Erev Sukkos, that little bit of Erev Sukkos, counts for 7 days. The 7 day of Sukkos counts for another 7 days. That's 14 days. Shmini Atzeres counts for 7 days because it's a whole Yom Tov. So that's 21 days. You only need 9 days after Sukkos and you're out of the shloshim, the 30-day mourning period. Now, if we therefore ask, since on Yom Tov you don't really do mourning, so if we ask, in such a scenario, how many days of mourning have you really observed? You've observed 10 days, part of Erev Sukkos, and the 9 days after Sukkos. Therefore, out of the shloshim, Avraham only kept 10 real days of mourning. Therefore, the chaf is gematria 20. The 20 in Lubchosa is diminished, because out of the 30 days of mourning he would have observed for her, 20 of them were taken away through this particular calculation.
That is nice.
Again, it's that is the halacha. The halacha today is... No. You say that, learn it from there. No. The halacha we know from other places, but this is taking the halacha that we know and incorporating it as an explanation of the small chaf. Yeah, this is the halacha. The halacha is that if you have a burial, Erev Sukkos, so Erev Sukkos counts for 7, 7 days of Sukkos counts for 7, Shmini Atzeres counts for 7, that's 21, and then Simchas Torah only counts for 1. You have another 9 days, 8 days after Simchas Torah, that's the end of the Shloshim period. Yeah, and there's no Shiva at all. Right. Yeah, every Yom Tov counts for 7 days. Well, let's put it this way. Let's assume a person buries a mace Erev Rosh Hashanah. So here, the way it works is this. Rosh Hashanah cancels the Shiva, and you observe Shloshim until Yom Kippur, and then Yom Kippur cancels out Shloshim. You don't even Yom Kippur cancels out the Shloshim. There is a question, why doesn't Shmini Atzeres cancel out the Shloshim? That's a question that commentaries ask. Because normally, a Shiva is cancelled if it began before a Yom Tov, and a Shloshim is cancelled if it begins before a Yom Tov. And yet Shmini Atzeres doesn't have that effect. Shmini Atzeres just counts for another 7. It does not annul the Shloshim per se.
If a person is buried on Erev Yom Kippur, everything is...
Well, the way it works is this. Yom Kippur cancels... Well, Yom Kippur cancels Shiva.
And Shloshim?
No, because... the thing is, Shloshim is only cancelled if it commenced before the Yom Tov. So you then have to observe Shloshim until Sukkos. And Sukkos will cancel out Shloshim. In other words, Shiva is only cancelled. Again, if you bury a mace on Chol HaMoed, Shiva is not cancelled. You have to observe Shiva after Yom Tov. Mm-hmm. Right? So Shiva is cancelled if it began before Yom Tov. And Shloshim is cancelled if it began before Yom Tov. So if, for example, a person buried a mace 8 days before Rosh Hashanah would cancel out Shloshim. Because a little bit of Shloshim began. Okay? So that's why Sukkos can cancel the Shloshim in the case of a Kvura before Yom Kippur. Right, so again, it's a remez. People see in this halacha, they see an allusion to this. I'm sorry, you had a question about Rivka and...
Now,
when you say the test for Rivka, which test are you referring to? Rivka gets a test, right. Well, I'm going to have to think about it some more, but I think the basic approach is that since Yitzchak represents a single midah of Gevurah, it was essential that... that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Eliezer find the shidduch for her, that is the exemplar in intensity of chesed, equal to Yitzchak's midah of gevurah. Mm-hmm. Since Yaakov is already a synthesis of those midas, so it was not necessary to find, exemplified in an extreme, the opposite midah. Yaakov already was the synthesis within his own character. Mm-hmm. That's probably connected. But I'll just leave you with one thought, I'm sure you've heard it before. The Drasha Saran raises the question, right, Eliezer had a daughter, right? And Eliezer said, "What about my daughter?" Mm-hmm. And that's why instead of Ulai, perhaps it says Eli to me. Mm-hmm. And Avram says, "No, that's not good enough." So the Drasha Zaran says, "Gee, what's wrong with Eliezer's daughter from such a religious family? And Avram's family are idol worshippers. Obdei Avodah Zarah. Why would Avram prefer that?" So the Drasha Zaran explains that it was known that in Avram's place, the people had the capacity of loving kindness and chesed. And the Ran says, chesed is something that is so important and so significant that it is better to marry an idolater who has the midah of chesed than to marry somebody who keeps all of the mitzvahs but does not have that midah of chesed to the same degree. Eliezer was not Jewish, but neither was
circumcised.
Rivka was not Jewish either.
Isn't that why they say not to go to the Canaan? Because right. The Canaan didn't have that midah.
That's correct. Okay. And the Canaan had a midah of achsarius. Now we find that in Avram's makom, the people had gemilah were gomli chasadim, and even Lavan. You might say Lavan is a cheater and everything else. But you see, a very interesting thing. You see, Lavan is a hypocrite. In fact, the very word Lavan, whitewash. You said to allude to but the important thing to see is this: in Lavan's hypocrisy, he always behaves externally in the guise of great hospitality. Mm-hmm. He's friendly, he's a brother, I have place for you, Anochi Panisi Abayas. And even hypocrisy, you know, Alexander Pope, I mentioned in Shilius, Alexander Pope used to say that hypocrisy is a tribute that vice pays to virtue. In other words, if, for example, in Saddam, nobody's a hypocrite, right? In Saddam, you don't make believe you're hospitable. It's the opposite. If you behaved in a hospitable way, you got in a lot of trouble. The very fact, I think, that Lavan has to hypocritically show kindness shows that kindness is something that is valued in that society. And Avraham Avinu knew this. And therefore, the Ran says, of course, you have to take Rivka out of her environment. You can't let her stay in that environment. That's why Avraham says, Chas v'shalom, do not take Yitzchak there. But when there's that capacity of chesed, it's like a diamond covered with dirt. You can wash off the dirt, but there's a panemius, there's something inside that can grow and develop, as opposed to ideology you can get later. If you're an Oved Avodah Zarah, you can change if you're exposed to the right teachings, but the chesed has to be something that is embodied in a person at a very young age. So that's a big issue when people wonder what they should look for in a shidduch. Just follow the Torah says. I mean, the Torah says, what did Avraham Avinu look for his son? It was not.
But it was Eliezer's idea that she'll be not. Avraham didn't tell him if.
But the Mefarshim say that the very fact. Yeah, but this is what the Ran is telling us. The very fact that Avraham said, "Go to my country," told Eliezer what he should be looking for. In other words, that's the connection. Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing, just one thing, then we'll break. That is, I raised this again in show, but it's a very, very good thought. The Eli, the double entendre, the Eli, if you recall, that does not appear when Eliezer talks to Avraham. When he talks to Avraham, he says, Ulai! The Eli only appears when he's telling it over to Lavan and Yeshua. So, the Mefarshim say, from here you see the tremendous loyalty of Eliezer as a shaliach. When he's talking to Avraham, he doesn't give himself away. He doesn't tell Avraham, maybe you choose my daughter. In other words, what Avraham hears is only one thing, total loyalty to the mission. It is only when he's talking to Lavan that for the very first time, we see what Eliezer really wanted. So the Torah's meramis to you that Eliezer was not equivocal in his mission. Eliezer was very, very loyal in carrying out his mission. And in fact, the only reason he told Lavan, or intimated to Lavan, is he wanted to flatter Lavan into saying, look how special you are. My own daughter was turned out. It's a way of enhancing his mission and not detracting from it. He could have, you know, booby-trapped it. He could have arranged all sorts of things where Lavan wouldn't come along, go along, and he, Bedavka, did not do that. Hand up.
I'm just wondering, why wasn't Eliezer considered a Jew?
Well, you know, this is the problem. The problem is this. The problem is the Torah says in Parshas Lech Lecha that the children of Avraham need to be circumcised, and the Avadim, the slaves of Avraham, need to be circumcised. Eliezer technically was an Eved Kanani. He was a Canaanite, a non-Jewish slave. Now the truth is, what is the halachic status of a non-Jewish Eved that has circumcision? The halacha is, he is kind of Jewish. In fact, the male is chayev in the same commandments as a regular Jewish woman. Of course, then of course the mitzvahs were totally different. So Eliezer did have the status of an Eved, but until he was freed, a Jew cannot marry an Eved normally. Again, it's not always clear if we assume the Eved kept all these mitzvahs or not, but according to Halacha, if I have an Eved, my daughter cannot marry an Eved Kanani. That's a prohibited relationship. Okay, well, I guess we'll stop here. We'll see you next week.
So what's going to be next week?
I have to give a thought. I just, for some reason, I just have a mental block about this. We'll work out some permanent topic.
Maybe
we'll develop it for luck. question is, what is if Hashem wants you to for Yitzchak? I don't have a clear answer. I mean, those who say that Avraham didn't pass the Akedah use that argument. But again, I don't think there's any possible interpretation that Avraham flunked the Akedah. Kadosh Baruch Hu told him afterwards that
we couldn't have gotten a greater bracha than
he got. Yeah. So.